I'm ready to be slut shamed if that's what it's like. I'm gonna dress provocatively because I like it.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
This is Gospel of Musical Theater. I'm Peter.
I'm Nathan. No and Dolly.
No Dolly.
But she's here. She's here in spirit.
She's here. She's coming down
coming down the steps. Hello.
She's got a hat on. She looks fabulous. God. It's so good to have her back.
Maybe, what do you want to say? The greatest entrance in Broadway history, I think, when Dolly shows up at the top of that staircase in the Harmonia Gardens.
It can't be beat. And in some ways, the whole show builds to that.
It's a show about that number. Oh, God, yeah. When everybody's just silent, and then she very delicately puts one slipper down, and immediately the orchestra, like, it's an amazing moment. I love that moment. It's so perfect. But it really is. It's a show about a woman going to dinner. I mean, really, that's the whole show, is setting up Dolly's going to go to the Harmonia Gardens. That really is the plot in some ways.
That's the plot. And it's a woman going to dinner who has moved through grief. And, you know, I think 1964, of course, we're going to talk about the Streisand movie because this is the Streisand series on Gospel Musical Theater. But we have to talk about the show first because the movie is really a stepchild of the phenomenon. So I think 1964, right after the Kennedy assassination, at the Tonys against Funny Girl. These two shows, we talked about Funny Girl in a previous episode, Hello Dolly, Streisand in Funny Girl on Broadway, Carol Channing in Hello Dolly on Broadway. Hello Dolly swept the Tonys.
Yep. It was a phenomenon.
Just a phenomenon. Gower Chapman, the great director, who I think must have created that scene of Dolly coming down, the music, the score. Carol Channing, who owned the role for the rest of her life. I think she said she played Dolly
into her 90s. It's like Yul Brynner as the king and Carol Channing as Dolly kind of reigned the regional circuit for. I remember Carol Channing coming through Portland playing Dolly. I don't think I saw her, but I remember her playing this role well into my lifetime. Yeah,
amazing. And so here's my thinking about it this morning. 1963, the assassination of JFK. 1969, by the time the movie got out, Vietnam going on. One of the criticisms of Barbara playing a widow, Dolly Levi, was she's too young. But there were a lot of young widows. Because I think in some ways, it's a story about recovery from grief, certainly in terms of Dolly's track. This is a woman who is still in love with her deceased husband.
First husband, yeah.
And she talks to him kind of like in a few years later, Tevye talks to God in Fiddler on the Roof. He's very much a character, even though he's not in the show.
We never see him. She never even shows us his picture. I kept waiting for her to turn. She always talks to a little cameo of him. We never actually get to see him, which is an interesting choice. And Dolly's relationship with her former husband, whom we never see in the film, right? She never shows us the cameo picture of him.
Right.
So he remains an unseen figure. And I think that's deliberate because the way that Dolly talks to Ephraim is actually very similar to the way that Tevye talks to God in Fiddler on the Roof. She's looking for a sign. Right? She's decided, I'm going to marry Horace Vandergelder. It's not a love match. He will take care of me. I think she realizes, like, I can be good for him. It's about financial security. She does, I guess, fall in love with him over the course of the show, although an actor can decide how she wants to play that. But she's looking for a sign. I've decided to do this, Ephraim. I've decided to rejoin the human race, and I would like you to give me away. Would you please give me a sign that you approve? So one way to kind of read the arc of Dolly's character is she's looking for a sign from God that what she has decided to do is actually God's will for her life. I mean, I suppose in the end of the show, she does get her sign. But that theological idea, which I think is hearkening back to Hebrew scripture, right? And isn't it Gideon who like puts out the fleece? You know, this idea, I mean, it's really a question question of, if I'm going to put a theological language around this question, how do you discern God's will? Is it appropriate to ask God for a sign? I've done that in my life. I don't know if you have. I always do it with a little bit of a sense of, like, you know, I have Jesus's voice in the temptation in the wilderness, do not put the Lord your God to the test. You know, like, I think there is also a biblical corrective against the idea that God is kind of like a dead husband who might send you a message from beyond the grave to point you in the right direction. And, you know, Dolly is not talking to God. She's talking to her dead husband. But my sense is Ephraim Levi functions as God in Dolly's theology of her existence. And she wants to know that she's doing the right thing. And some of that, as you say, is her working through her grief at having lost her. I mean, I assume, you know, she even says it will not be a marriage in the sense that we had a marriage. She was deeply in love with Ephraim Levi. My sense is he was older, because a lot of what she does is quote him, right? He taught her. He shaped her. He formed who she is. And now she's ready to kind of take this next step into her life. But it's really important to her that he give her away, that he bless this next part of her life, which does feel to me like a woman who has discerned what she wants to do, but is looking for confirmation from God that it's the right thing.
Yeah. And I think one of the strong things about Hello, Dolly is it comes from a really strong book. The play, The Matchmaker by Thornton Wilder, we saw it a few years ago, professional production in Vancouver. And our thought after it, as my husband and I were driving home, was, it's a great play. We are missing the songs. Like it's almost like the book of Hello, Dolly took basically the dialogue, whole scenes, and then added in songs. So with this really, really strong book, Thornton Wilder, always writing great characters, wrote a very complex person in Dolly Levi, and a very complex set of social relations around marriage, around the economics of marriage, and I think around grief. Back to 1964, Jackie Kennedy was a young widow, and the nation, really the world, had been through a moment of enormous grief with the assassination of President Kennedy. And then on Broadway in 64 pops up this, you know, Hello, Dolly. And people were saying, have we forgotten, you know, is this just tits and glitz and trying to have us forget our troubles? I mean, I watched it again. I thought, actually, no, this is a story of a woman who is coming out of grief and dealing with economics, as Jackie Kennedy did in marrying Aristotle.
And would go on to do.
Yeah, yeah. And in the film, 69, Jerry Herman, the great Jerry Herman, I mean, can we just say for a moment, there's a bit of a war between Jerry Herman fans and Stephen Sondheim fans. I think it's possible to love them both for what they do and what they do successfully. And Jerry Herman writes a popular song like nobody else.
Like
really
nobody
can.
Else.
It's great. He writes a new opening for Barbara, a new opening for Dolly in the film, which I think is better than the Broadway opening, than the stage play opening. Just leave everything to me. And it, just to talk about Barbara for a sec, well, we're talking about Barbara for a whole series here, but he wrote a song perfect for her song interpretation skills. It couldn't be better. It couldn't be better.
If you want your ego bolstered, muscles toned, or chair upholstered, just leave everything to me. Charming social introductions, expert mandolin instructions, just leave everything to me. If you want your culture rounded, French improved, or torso pounded, with a 10-year guarantee. If you want a birth recorded, collies bred, or kittens boarded, I'll proceed to plan the whole procedure. Just leave everything to me.
It is a Barbara song for sure. I think they knew that. What's the Carol Channing number that opens, I put my hand in?
Yeah.
It's just, it's too slow. Barbara needs, you know, she needs something that allows her to talk fast, spit a lot of lyric, and basically own the screen from the minute she walks onto it, which Just Everything to Me does. It also sets up the character in a really, right, like she, you know, she's the gimmick, I think this is a Thornton Wilder gimmick, is she's handing out her business card to everybody, and they're all, you know, like entirely specific to that one particular situation. It's a great little bit. But she basically, like, she's a meddler, right? I think that's what, you know, like, what you need to understand about this woman is that everybody's business is Dolly's business. She, and in that sense, she's a quasi-divine character. I mean, or at least, I mean, how do we want to, you know, she's the trickster in the piece.
Yeah, trickster.
She's a little bit of, in sort of Roman satire drama, she's the parasite. She's the one who sits next to the moneyed character and is sponging off of him. I mean, basically always, like, looking for a free dinner, which literally, I mean, one way of reading Hello, Dolly! Is it's a woman who's, like, wants somebody else to pay for her to go to dinner at the Harmonia Gardens, her favorite restaurant, right? Like, that is, Dolly basically eats. Like, she, in that sense, I don't know. Barbara doesn't say that that's her doorway into the character. She does say, I didn't really ever understand Dolly. I never really knew what to do with this. I knew I was too young for the role. I knew I shouldn't be playing the role. And I'd never really feel like I had a handle on the role. My sense is what works when Barbara works in that role is when she is talking really fast and being the kind of girl from Brooklyn. I mean, basically kind of playing Yenta in Fiddler on the Ring. I mean, really playing up the Jewishness of Dolly. The character is actually not Jewish in the way that Thornton Wilder envisioned her. I think she's Catholic. She's an Irish girl.
Irish Gallagher, but, you know, but was her maiden
Gallagher,
name before,
right.
Levi.
Gallagher Levi. But Barbara plays up the Levi bit, right?
Yeah.
For Barbara, Dolly is a Jewish matchmaker. She's a fast-talking girl from Brooklyn. That works. And then when she eats, and she eats, you know, the famous, the scene in the Harmonia Gardens where she's, you know, cutting his turkey. I mean, like, that's basic. I think that's Barbara's best moment in the whole thing, is when she's eating, because Dolly loves to eat, and Dolly knows that if she's going to continue to dine out at the places she wants to dine out in, she's going to need money to do it. So she, you know, picks herself a half millionaire, Horace Vandergelder, who's going to pay for it all.
I love that. I also think Just Leave Everything to Me is, interestingly, a comment about Barbara's own character, about Barbara as a person. She wants, like, leave everything to me. Right. I have...
Let me do everything.
I have an idea about the cinematography on this, which in her autobiography, she had fights with Fred Astaire, who directed it, about the shots
Gene Kelly,
for,
yeah.
Before the parade passes by. She thought he was doing it wrong. She had thoughts about Walter Matthau. She had thoughts about everybody in that movie, and it was a terrible experience, as you said. But also just thinking about the arc of her career. By the time she gets to, you know, do Yentl, Just Leave Everything to Me. I am starring in this. I'm working on the soundtrack. I'm directing it, et cetera, et cetera. So when I see her do that, it's there. I think Jerry Herman has tapped into, by writing that lyric with that great melody, given Barbara something she can chew on besides food.
Yep, she chews the scenery all over that number. She's in a great dress to do it. She does talk in the autobiography. In some ways, she says the best part of Hello, Dolly! Were the clothes.
Yeah.
She has only six costumes in the whole thing, which is kind of astounding. And the of course the famous one we'll talk about when she makes her grand entrance on the top of the staircase of the Harmonia Gardens. That dress weighed 40 fucking pounds,
Holy, apparently. Man.
And cost more than any costume had ever cost a movie studio. It was I was an unbelievable amount, because it was all hand stitched with Swarovski crystals, and, you know, yeah, the whole thing. But, you know, it's a great moment. So she loved the clothes, hated the role. But in some ways, she kind of, as with Funny Girl, she plays Barbra Streisand.
Yes.
She kind of filters Dolly through the lens of Barbra Streisand. And there is a way in which that actually kind of works.
I think it
for
works.
This character.
I think it works.
I think it works too.
Yeah.
It's not the only way. Carol Channing's Dolly is very different than Streisand's Dolly, who is very different from Pearl Bailey's Dolly or Donna Murphy's Dolly. Or, I mean, one of the reasons why I think this show has such a life is... female actors of a certain age can put their stamp on this thing. It's a good star vehicle. That character can be custom tailored to the talents of particular actors in really interesting ways.
Well, and Bette Midler most recently, and then Imelda Staunton in London, summer of 2024, which would be great. Yeah, the film did spent a lot of money. There was a reviewer in Slant magazine who said, the quote is, "more infamous for bringing Fox financially to its knees than for being the last major musical directed by Gene Kelly. Hello, Dolly is one big-assed bull in a china shop. The film cost nearly as much to produce as Cleopatra and made far less at the box office, thus earning its film reputation as one of Hollywood's foremost turkeys." But when it was released on VHS, anybody out there in podcast land remember VHS, the video cassette?
It was a double VHS. I think it was Act One. Yep. I remember it. I remember that box set from the library.
It soared. That's where it made its money back. I think community theaters, schools, professional companies wanting to see this show, they could just pop in a VHS, see Streisand do it, and it sold. Well, you grew up with this show. This was...
Yep, it was one of my... Yeah, if I'm home from school, that was one of the things... Homesick from school, that was one of the films that I would pop in. It was a great sick day at home movie. And that's how I discovered Barbra Streisand. That was probably the first thing I ever saw her in, was Hello, Dolly. So yeah, it's a film that I have a very affectionate relationship with because I've seen it so many times as a kid. I watched it again last night. You know, as a movie musical, it is a little bit of kind of the end of an era in a certain kind of way. Gene Kelly's direction mostly I find kind of unimaginative. I mean, Michael Kidd is the choreographer of the film. The dance numbers are
phenomenal.
Great. Yeah. It's a phenomenally choreographed film. Although they always kind of come out of nowhere. You know, it's like this. They don't. You know, it's very clearly Michael Kidd, and then Gene Kelly will kind of come back in and do kind of weird things. You know, there's a lot of bright colors. It feels like a film that's kind of 10 years behind the times,
yeah,
in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
And Barbra lip syncs most of it. And she's right. She's not a good lip syncer.
No.
I
was watching one of her numbers, can't remember what it was, last night. And my thought as I watched her lips move and listen to the sound, I thought, she is deliberately doing this badly. Because she hates
she
it so much.
She probably is.
You know,
she
doesn't want any illusion that she's actually singing. Because her sync was, or maybe it was just the YouTube video I was watching.
No, her sync is not that
her
good.
Sync, I mean, is some terrible. Of it,
it's not that good. Maybe you're right. Maybe that's deliberate. I think it is. I mean, it is for her as an artist, lip syncing offends against her deepest sensibilities. So there is a way in which, whether she's conscious of it or not, I think she is, it is abhorrent to her. The practice of lip syncing to a track that she laid down, you know, maybe 6 months earlier, is abhorrent to her as an artist. And also, you know, when you close your eyes and listen to her, you know, listen to the vocal performance on the musical numbers, it's great. They're great performances. You can hear what she did in the studio. She's an incredible performer of this material. 6 months later, in costume, lip syncing to her own vocal track, you lose it. The visual performance is really, there are a couple places where I think she, you know, like it succeeds. But really, she's at her best when they're filming her kind of from the back. And what you've got is a body moving around in sync with, or kind of with dancers. And she and Michael Kidd apparently did work together really well. And she's a good dancer.
She
pulls off the choreography. I think when she's dancing, it's pretty good. When they're filming her in close-up, though, lip-syncing to her own tracks, the film really does fall apart. And when she's not on screen, the movie is not that interesting.
No. And Walter Matthau is... Can we talk about
Walter Matthau's
terrible.
Ew. I mean, he does play curmudgeon.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of... Matthau, basic... And really, that's all you need. I mean, Horace Van Der Gelder is not that interesting of a character, really. Maybe, you know, David Hyde Pierce played him opposite Bette Midler. I never saw that production. Apparently, he was quite good. I think he got nominated for a Tony.
Yes, he did.
So there is a piece of me that think, you know, and Thornton Wilder's original conception of this story was actually, I think, about Horace Van Der Gelder, right? The original play was The Merchant of Yonkers, I think.
That's right.
Completely tanked. So then he's like, well, I guess maybe Dolly's the more interesting character here. So
yes.
Kind of rewrote it as the matchmaker, kind of putting Dolly at the center of it. Dolly is not a part. I mean, there's a long lineage to this material. I think it goes back to Roman satire. But it's basically a story about young lovers and kind of the complications of a marriage plot. It's farce. It's almost commedia dell'arte.
Yes.
It's a marriage plot. And then Thornton Wilder has the genius to kind of expand the role of a very minor character in it, this kind of marriage broker, and make her the center of it. And suddenly it becomes Hello, Dolly.
Yes.
And as Walter Matthau, you know, went to the head of the studio filming it, having such, you know, he chafed against Barbara. He didn't like the way that she tried to direct the film. I think she kind of tried to direct him, which he hated. And she tells the story in the autobiography. He was best friends with Sidney Chaplin.
Yeah.
Who had, you know, like, had an affair with Barbara. She had broken up with him. He treated her horribly. She sued him at Actors Equity. They sided with Sidney. But, you know, Sidney basically had been telling stories all around town about what a bitch she was.
Well, Walter Matthau and Sidney played poker together.
She said, I went up against the boys.
So she
could never figure out why he hated her so much. Finally, she, you know, like, confronts him in his dressing room. And he's like, yeah, I hate you because I'm friends with Sidney. And she's like, do you want to hear my side of the story? And he was not interested in her side of the story. He had decided that she was trouble.
Well, and old enough to be her grandfather, really. I mean, so it was mismatched, miscast in that way. But in the great song, It Takes a Woman, an anthem to misogyny and heteronormativity.
And to the economics of marriage from a man's perspective. I mean, you know, like, and the song is broadly satirical, right? I mean, like, the joke kind of gets pounded into your, by, it doesn't need eight choruses, right? We get it right off the bat. It takes a woman to shovel the shit, basically, right? Like, he wants a wife to take care of his household. He wants somebody to, like, darn his socks and muck up the stables. I mean, that's what the song is about, right? It takes a sweet, innocent young woman is the one who can get her hands dirty. And so the song is basically satirizing, right? Like, that's all that Horace wants is, and all of the men put their hands on their chest and sing this hymn to femininity.
God bless them,
and in the winter she'll shovel the ice and lovingly set out the traps for the mice. She's a joy and treasure for practically speaking. To whom can you turn when the plumbing is leaking?
To that dainty woman, that fragile woman, that sweetheart, that mistress, that wife.
Oh, yes, it takes a woman,
a husky woman,
to bring you the sweet things in life.
Oh, yes, it takes a woman, a dainty woman, a sweetheart, a mistress, a wife. Oh, yes, it takes a woman, a fragile woman, to bring you the sweet things in life.
It is satire. It's satirizing kind of the role that a woman plays in a traditional marriage.
Yeah. And gendering the domestic arts.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That this is women's work, and that a man would not do this. And that is unfair deeply to women and to men, the complete gendering of the domestic arts onto women, and more important things having to do with money and power and prestige really belong to men.
Yeah. I mean, it is a little, you know, there. It is interesting the kind of the stuff that he pulls out that Horace Van der Gelder in the lyric wants a woman to do, right? It takes a female for setting the table. That's a traditional feminine thing.
Right.
Weaving the Guernsey, cleaning the stable. Basically, it gets kind of worse and worse, right? She's lovingly going to set out the traps for the mice. She's going to shovel the ice. She's the one you turn to when the plumbing is leaking. So it is a little more than just,
it's
I need
management
her to darn.
Of the house. Management,
it's management
of the
house.
Yeah.
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 And, you know, and the joke in the song is she's so fragile, but then what he's asking her to do is basically fix the plumbing. So it is, the image of femininity that's being sketched is we're going to dismiss her as small and weak and delicate, but we're going to ask her to do actually pretty muscular, athletic, mechanically minded things. So I think that's the joke of the song is, right, like you actually are asking a woman to do all the things that by this characterization of men and female, male and female roles, a man should be doing. You're asking her to basically be the man and the woman in this relationship, yeah. But then you're going to dismiss her as the sweet little woman at home. So in some ways, it does, in a kind of tongue-in-cheek way, point up the ridiculousness at the heart of patriarchy.
Yes. Well, it makes me think of, is it the in Proverbs that there's the noble wife narrative?
Yeah,
and,
right.
You know, some of my friends have, you know, not wanted that when it, clergy friends, not wanted that when it comes in the lecture. If you read the thing, this woman is extraordinary what she does and is actually interpreted as a celebration of the strength and remarkable character of women in relationship to men rather than a put down of the little woman, right?
Right, yeah, right. Yeah, the song is trying to have it both ways, right?
Yes.
We both are going to dismiss her as the little woman, but then also ask her to be, basically to do everything,
yes.
Right? Horace Vandergelder wants a woman to basically run his entire business for him. And actually, that is what Dolly is both capable of doing.
Absolutely.
And at least in the context of the show, that seems to be what she wants. You know, she walks into his shop and you see her, Barbara plays this moment great, looking around like, oh God, this place is such a mess, what I could do with it. And then that's the sign, right? Right, she in the very first scene we see her, like, she looks at the shutters, she's like, ah, these shutters should be forest green, you know, like she's redecorating his store. And then at the end of the thing, that's how she knows that Ephraim has blessed this marriage, is when Horace, you know, basically unprompted, you know, tells the workman, I want all of the shutters to be forest green, and she like stops her, right, like, I can't believe I just heard him say it. And then he goes on to quote her dead husband without realizing it, and that's the sign that she's been looking for. So there is a way in which Dolly remakes Horace into the husband she wants, rather than the other way around, right? Like the song, It Takes a Woman, is sort of him saying, I'm gonna take this woman and she's gonna do what I want her to do. I think the show is actually siding with Dolly in the sense of a smart woman can remake a man into the image of what she wants him to be. There's a piece of me that doesn't, I don't know, like that trope, which is, I don't know that that's patriarchy, but it's a trope that I don't, you know, that's kind of the meddling housewife.
Yeah.
I don't know that I love that trope any more than the sweet little woman who's fixing the plumbing.
Right. And how, because I think the social issue from when Thornton Wilder wrote it through Dolly's early years is, how can women own power in the post-industrial revolution, in a patriarchal age? What is the way? And think 1964, it's not long before we're into the women's liberation movement, reproductive choice issues, women conscientized by the pill, having control over their bodies, which prior to was. So I think it's playing with all those important forces as well. And Carol Channing kind of doing it on Broadway in 1964. I mean, I just kind of think about it. These New York audiences coming thinking, okay, we're going to have an evening of fluff. And there's great songs and, you know, it's well constructed and all that sort of thing. But my hunch is, while audiences are sitting there thinking about it, they're thinking about grief. They're thinking about relationships with our ancestors, our spouses who have gone. They're thinking about the roles of women and men and relationships and love. Like, it kind of sneaks up on you, this Hello Dolly thing, from being a big brassy musical to actually provoking in our consciousness some really important issues and thoughts, right?
There is, yeah, I think there is a really interesting satire of straight marriage in this thing, and the class and economics of marriage. Every woman in Hello Dolly is very aware that she is property And that she, and to a certain, I mean, I think about Irene Malloy, right? Like, she, you know, she even says, like, I'm a dressmaker. Women only come into my shop to speculate on how wicked I am. So I have to be so careful. I don't get to go to dinner. I don't get to go to the opera. I don't get to go to the ballet. I never date because my economic life depends on not being the prostitute they think I am. But they all think I'm a wicked woman. So in some ways, her version of Before the Parade Passes By is, shit, I'm going to close up shop. I'm going to liquidate my business. And I'm going to go have a fun night on the town with these boys, because I'm ready to, you know, it's like, if everybody thinks I'm a wicked woman, I may as well do it. And that's Ribbons Down My Back, right? Which we weren't even sure, you know, it's like, it's kind of a forgettable song. But actually, in some ways, like, you know, if the dolly at the center of your production is not that interesting, cast a juggernaut actor as Irene Malloy and let her sell Ribbons Down My Back, which is all about, like, I've decided basically I'm gonna dress provocatively because I like the way it feels, and more to the point, a man might notice me.
And so I will proudly wear ribbons down my back, shining in my hair.
I'm ready to take agency of my body. I'm ready to be slut-shamed, if that's what it's like. I'm gonna dress provocatively because I like it, and I like the attention it brings me. And it is kind of it's not a scandalous song. It's actually a very gentle kind of love ballad. But underneath the gentleness of that lyric is something that I think in a couple years is gonna explode into the women's movement. I mean, Irene Malloy is not, she's not quite burning her bra, but she's stepping pretty close to it.
Yeah.
And she's also very aware, at the end of my great day as a slut, I'm going to marry Horace Vandergelder. I don't love him, but he's got money, and I need money. And what I've got is a good reputation and good looks, and I can manage his household for him. And Dolly, basically, then, she's the one that does it. But every woman in this piece is very aware of herself as kind of an economic good, and to a certain degree is taking agency within the very limited means that their society offers them to make that work for them in a way they want to. So it is a little more sophisticated than a piece of nostalgic fluff.
It is.
About a more innocent time.
And in fact, kind of the heart of it, just before Ribbons Down My Back, you've got the hero's journey that Barnaby and mm-hmm. Cornelius and Dolly take off on in Put On Your Sunday Clothes. Like, they're gonna, and it's really a classic hero's journey, right? They're leaving Yonkers, they get on the train, they're gonna dress in a different way, they're gonna go to New York where great things happen, they're gonna be transformed, and then they're gonna go back as different people.
Out there's a world outside of Yonkers, way out there beyond this hick town, Barnaby. There's a slick town, Barnaby. Out there, full of shine and full of sparkle. Close your eyes and see it. Listen, Barnaby. Listen, Barnaby. Put on your Sunday clothes, there's lots of world out there. Get out the brilliantine and dime cigars. We're gonna find adventure in the evening air. Girls in white in a perfume night with the lights as bright as the stars. Put on your Sunday clothes, we're gonna ride through town in one of those new horse-drawn open cars. We'll see the shows at Delmonico's, and we'll close the town in a whirl, and we won't come home until we've kissed a girl.
We won't come home until we've kissed a girl.
We won't come home until we've discovered love, right? And
right.
This is classic archetypal hero's journey stuff, dressed up in 19th century fabulous clothes. And then they get there. Go ahead.
Well, I was just saying, it's all about the clothes.
It's all about the clothes.
It's so interesting that that is the image in the right, like put on your Sunday clothes, right? Like own, which I think is both wear your best because you're gonna feel more confident in your best clothes, but it's also like look. I mean, and so much of Barnaby and Cornelius and Irene and Minnie, elegance is about this too, right?
Yes.
Fake a higher class yes. than you are actually in order to get what you want. Class is arbitrary. It can be faked. It can, you know,
it's
all
performed.
Basically all of
it's performative.
It's performed.
Yeah.
Yes. All gender is performative. Class is performative. The whole, you know, there's a way in which, like, I think the more interesting love story at the heart of Hello, Dolly is that Barnaby and Cornelius have been, you know, making out downstairs and are probably like, you know, like there's a reason why Cornelius ends up in a closet full of boas and feathers. There's a queer reading that's not that far underneath.
No.
You know, it's like Irene. Like, what are Irene and Minnie getting up to? You know, like, they partner off with each other. But there's a piece of me that wants to say, I think the show is pretty clear-eyed about the performativity of male-female partnering in
yes.
this thing. It is all about the clothes. And Cornelius and Barnaby would probably be just as happy together as Cornelius and Irene are going to be. It only takes a moment.
Right. Well, and so elegance, I think, is... I think Elegance is one of my favorite songs from
Me too. I love
Hello,
Elegance. Partially because it's such a good Jerry Herman lyric.
Yes.
It's a sophisticated lyric.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a very sophisticated lyric. It's a great tune. And it unfolds very gently and gives lots of room for, as you say, costumes, for actors to strut their stuff. But it really is about, as you say, about class, about gender, about relationships, about how we perform ourselves, how we do ourselves in public spaces.
Middle class, don't speak of it, savoir faire. We reek of it, some were born with rags and patches, but we use dollar bills for matches. And
Vanderbilt, how bows to us.
J.P. Morgan scrapes and bows to us.
We got elegance, we were born with elegance.
I behave like Walter Raleigh when the streets are full of mud.
And the bluest huckleberry isn't bluer than my blood.
Have you noticed when I hold my cup, the saucer never moves?
And the way I keep my pinky up indubitably proves that
we got elegance, we got built in elegance.
And, you know, I often think at an ordination, we should sing elegance as clergy get vested, right? Especially in the Anglican Episcopalian tradition, where there's a lot of discussion about clothes. I mean, it's no mistake that Anglican clergy are called men of the cloth, or used to be called men of the cloth, since clothes uh-huh. and the debates that rage, the bitchy debates that rage within clergy about, mm-hmm. did you see what so-and-so wore? I can't believe yeah. they wore that together.
Bill Lupfer, whom you know, my mentor used to say, I think he picked this up from somebody else, you know, you walk into a Baptist sacristy and there'll be a Bible there. You walk into a Catholic sacristy and there's a crucifix on the wall. You walk into an Anglican or Episcopal sacristy and what do you find on the wall? A full-length mirror. Because what we worship is wanting to make sure we look good before we walk out on
We've
stage.
We've got elegance, you know.
Put on your Sunday clothes.
Put
when
on
you
your
feel
Sunday
down
clothes.
I mean, you know, strut down the street and have your picture took. I mean, and there is a piece of me, I don't know, like that's so queer.
Yeah.
That's so, it's part of what I love about this show, which is that little kind of wink. I mean, this is Jerry Herman. He probably wrote Elegant, you know, he probably wrote it on Fire Island.
Right.
Hanging out with his, you know, like probably in the nude, but then they're all going to put on, their little Speedos and their fab, and they're going to parade down the street in their Sunday best, which is a very different Sunday best than what Hello Dolly. But like, they're drawing the line. All of life is drag. Like RuPaul says this, right? Like we're all born naked. The rest is drag. drag. I think queer people have always known that. And there's a way in which, like, all of these characters, to a certain degree, are very queer. They are all very in touch with the ways in which their society asks them to perform a role. So they're gonna, like, embrace the performativity and make it work for them. And I think that is what it means to be queer in some ways,
yeah.
Right? To use the master's tools to take down the master's house. And so Hello, Dolly, in some ways, is a very subversive show being offered to the bourgeois population of straight people in 1964 who have just lost JFK and are reeling. And so it's like, here's a little nostalgic throwback to the 1890s, everybody. They take it to the bank. They make a ton of money. But the show is actually saying something really interesting about human beings and love relationships and class. I think that's part of why I love this show so much. It's actually very sophisticated.
It's sophisticated. It's vaudeville. It's burlesque in some ways. I think about the set classically is a proscenium arch, the orchestra pit, and then a ramp around the orchestra pit where you can put on your Sunday clothes for that number. And then before the parade passes by, you can do that. There's so much showing off clothes, vamping, really, vamp till you're ready. And before the parade passes by, I mean, it's a great song, from any composer. It may be one of Jerry Herman's.
Nobody really knows who it's by.
It was, you know.
Maybe Jerry Herman.
Like Send in the Clowns.
Maybe Bob Merrill.
It was a late addition to the show. The show wasn't working for the end of the first act, which is kind of a crucial moment to leave the audience wanting more and establish your characters and define it. And it's really a song about recovery from grief or a decision that I am no longer going to identify myself primarily because I'm a grieving person. I am going to take my part in the flow of life again and join in the parade of life. And this is a hugely courageous song for anyone who's been grieving can identify with. A moment may not happen in a moment, maybe happen over a period of time, but a decision, damn it, I'm going to get back into the flow of life. And I'm going to join the parade of human drama, the tragedy, the love, the comedy, the whole thing. And I want to do it before it's over.
Before the parade passes by, I've got to go and taste Saturday's high life. Before the parade passes by, I've got to get some life back into my life. I'm ready to move out in front. I've had enough of just passing my life. With the rest of them, with the best of them, I can hold my head up high. For I've got to go again, I've got to drive again, I've got to feel my heart coming alive again. Before the parade passes by.
It's No Day Like Today from Rent. I mean, it's the same, I think, kind of song and leaves the audience wanting more.
Right. It's a great act one closure. I mean, in some way, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Barbara's act one closer in Funny Girl is Don't Rain on My Parade.
Yes.
Which is a similar sort of big anthem to, we might say, self-empowerment. I mean, that's kind of how we treated Don't Rain on My Parade. Before the parade passes by, in some ways, is, you know, it's an older woman. Right. Or at least is the way the character is written, yes. A woman in her mid-40s.
There you are,
Nathan. Mid-40s. So, yeah, that's when a woman is so old that we don't even, you know, she's like basically one foot in the grave. But she is, right? Like, that's what she's saying is I kind of thought I was done, but maybe not. Maybe there's still there's life in the old girl yet. I mean, and I don't know. I mean, you tell me, had there been a Broadway show that gave us a midlife woman decide, you know, like is Hello Dolly, did Hello Dolly get there first? Because this becomes now a whole, right? Like Mame is in some ways picking up on this. Gypsy.
Rather than embracing the life, doesn't Mama Rose just kind of.
Yeah, she has a nervous breakdown.
She has a nervous breakdown. Yeah. She's not really able to embrace the new. I don't
yeah.
think.
Yeah, I mean, for Ethel, as a set piece for Ethel Merman, it is a triumphal return to the stage. They, I mean, so significantly, right? Like, when they started working with the Thornton Wilder material, they wanted to, actually...
they wrote it for Ethel.
Jerry Herman wrote it for Ethel Merman, and then Ethel Merman turned him down. I don't want to do shows anymore. I'm done with this. And when they saw Carol Channing and decided that she was right for... I think he had to rewrite everything, because Carol Channing's voice is entirely different.
Right.
And apparently then, when Ethel Merman came back and played Dolly, she restored a bunch of the songs that Jerry Herman had written for her.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so I guess that's right. Gypsy is probably the antecedent
closest
here, right? Seeing Ethel Merman, who's still at the top of her game and can still, you know, belt a house down. So let's build a vehicle for Ethel Merman. And here's a character who's in kind of her in midlife. That's a good character for Ethel. But then in some ways, I think kind of creates the industry of mid-career actresses having a comeback. Because every, you know, Ginger Rogers, Mary Martin, Pearl Bailey, like everybody played and plays. This role. It is the comeback role. Yeah, and I don't think that was really a thing in culture, kind of mid-career actors having a comeback in their 40s before Gypsy and Dolly and Mame kind of started creating properties like this for divas,
yeah,
we might say.
Yeah. So it's a powerful song, I think, for women of a certain generation. Barbara's too young, although her version of Before the Parade Passes By is brilliant. I watched the Bette Midler version of it last night on a YouTube, and she absolutely sells it by undersinging it, right? She lets it build, which a Jerry Herman song can certainly do.
Can do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it sets up well then the Act Two opener. Well, not opener. I mean, Elegance is really the beginning of Act. But that's basically Elegance exists so that we can do something before in front of the curtain, so that we can have a reveal then in Scene Two, Act Two, which is the Harmonia Gardens,
yes,
which is the great moment of the show, right? I mean, basically all of Hello Dolly builds to seeing that actress at the top of a staircase, dead silence, and then she begins to walk down it.
Hello, Rudy. Well, hello, Harry. It's so nice to be back home where I belong. You are looking swell. I can tell, Danny, you're still glowing, you're still crowing, you're still going strong. I feel the room swaying for the band. Playing one of my old favorite songs from way back when. So, bridge that gap, fellas, find me an empty lap. Fellas, Dolly, you'll never go away again.
Well, and that's, again, the she can go back to the restaurant. She can go back to a place where she was known.
She can go back to her
favorite
restaurant.
She can go back there because she has moved through a period of grief. And now the lyrics just all say it. It's great to have you back where you belong. You're looking swell. We can tell you're still glowing.
Glowing, crowing, going strong.
Going strong. Okay.
So,
there you go.
I mean, yes, she is still growing. Theologically,
but she's
right?
Also crowing. What is crowing?
Oh my God, she's crowing. Well, yeah. What is crowing?
And
who are they? I mean, there is a piece of, you know, the whole, I guess, you know, Dolly gets a couple choruses, right? I mean, she does, you know, it begins with her, hello, Stanny. Well, hello, Rudolph, whatever, right? Like, she's naming all of her boys, basically. I was watching this last night, right? Barbara and her boys. What is this, 1968? I'm wondering, like, how many of those boys died of AIDS?
Yes.
I mean, I think part of why Hello, Dolly, that moment always makes me cry. Yeah. Part of it is part of it is the staging of, right, like the dress, the whole, you know, like a woman at the top of the staircase. The audience invariably bursts into applause.
It always stops the show.
So at one level, right, like it just works at me at that level. And then as I was thinking about it, I'm, you know, watching the diva and her boys, and you know, all those boys are, you know, like getting together after the show to get in some shenanigans. I mean, like you did chorus parts.
Yes.
We've all been in the chorus of Hello. And so part of it is the adulation that the boys have for their, I mean, that show is queer diva culture encapsulated in a moment.
In one song.
It's the dancing.
Yeah.
Into one song. It's a bunch of boys singing about the middle-aged woman that they love. She's still glowing. She's still crowing. She's still going. So yeah, at one level, right? Like, what does crowing mean? It means she's still got it. Like, and they identify with her. Now, there's a piece of me that's like, you know, like she used to go there with her, you know, actually this is, they asked Hal Prince to direct the show and he's like, I'll do it if you cut this stupid Hello Dolly number. Why is she like, why do they care about her coming back? The show never gives us, you know, he's like, there's no context for this. Why do they like her so much? I think it's that, you know, she used to go there with her husband.
Yes.
She spent a lot of money on expensive dinners.
Yes.
So to a certain degree, they love her because she pays them really good tips. I mean, there's the economics of this relationship.
And she knows their names.
She knows their names. She knows their stories.
Lots of folks in upper class don't bother, right? Yeah. I mean, I'm sure many patrons wouldn't have known Stanley and so forth, but
they're anonymous. They're just workers.
She knows their names.
When it's Barbara, she's almost flirting with them, right? Yeah. Lose some weight, Stanley. I think you did, Stanley. You know, like she's, you know, so you get the sense of like, yeah, she's known them. In a couple of cases, it's like, I think she and Stanley had a little thing, although I also suspect that Stanley and Rudolph had a thing. So it doesn't matter, right? Like they've all been friends for forever. And that's when she talks about them, right? She's like, oh, no, they're friends. These are friends. Dolly has people she works for, like Vandergelt. You know, she's a marriage broker. She's kind of in their class in a certain way. She understands herself to also be essentially in a service profession, working for people who are basically paying her to be their friend in a kind of professional way. She understands herself to be a kind of a waiter, and she knows that those are her people, right? They're my friends. These are my dearest friends. They understand me. So when she comes home again, I mean, you know, she's in tears, they're in tears. I don't know, something about that moment really is powerful to me. And I think some of it is the economics of that, but then underneath it, like the deep kind of identification that you have with people who see you, people who know that you see them, even if they're, you know, like in their job in which most people don't see them. But Dolly treats them well. Dolly tips them well. And she looks fabulous.
She looks fabulous.
She dresses up for dinner. When she comes, everything goes more, you know, it's like they're all, Rudolph even says, like, I want everything double time tonight. And they do this incredible Michael Kidd ballet getting ready for her to come. They operate better. Things just work better when Dolly's in the room. She is magic. I don't know. Like I find that so beautiful, that depiction of a restaurant, because at the end of the day, it's all about a restaurant.
It's all about food. And, in the movie, brilliantly, they let Louis Armstrong, Louis Armstrong,
who made the song a hit. Louis Armstrong.
It topped the charts when the Beatles were popular.
Off the chart.
It beat everything. With him singing Hello Dolly. One of the things I love about the song Hello Dolly is the banjo. There's usually a banjo in the instrumentation that just it makes it kind of Dixieland in a certain way. I know. Brings a certain feel to the thing. And certainly in the Louis Armstrong recording of it, the banjo figured heavily. So we've got, and in the film, Barbara's connection with Louis Armstrong is really a beautiful, it feels genuine. I don't know how many takes they took.
It does feel genuine. Yeah, he was only on set for one day, so it can't have been that many takes.
Yeah.
They must have pre-recorded it. Yeah, I was paying attention to that too, because I'm like, because there is as soon as you put Louis Armstrong on screen, he is the only black person in that film.
Yes.
Well, with the exception of the rest of the band, they're up in a forgotten corner of the Harmonia Gardens. So they're, I mean, like, absolutely accessories to white people's lives. And actually, the way that we have tended to teach Hello Dolly is kind of doing it in the context of, you know, the construction of whiteness, the all-white world, the great white way, right? Like, Hello Dolly is kind of one of the great texts in terms of thinking about how whiteness is constructed. I think it's a really interesting text in terms of looking at the sociology of whiteness. And then there's Louis Armstrong, you know, who made that song a hit. That's the reason why the show is titled Hello, Dolly, because he made that song a hit. And so the producer's like, well, I guess, you know, Dolly, a damned exasperating woman, is actually not a title that's going to sell tickets. But everybody knows this new title, Hello, Dolly.
Hello, as Daryl, comma, as Daryl, Dolly, exclamation
Dolly,
mark.
Yes. As Daryl Zanuck said to Walter Matthau when he went in to complain about Barbra Streisand, Walter, the show is not called Hello, Walter. It's called Hello, Dolly, or yeah. Hello, Barbara. Yeah. But then Louis Armstrong and Barbara have this moment. And
it's
yeah,
a beautiful
like you,
moment.
It feels to me like a passing of a baton
yes.
in a certain kind of way.
Well, hello.
Look who's here.
Dolly. This is Louis.
Hello, Louis.
Dolly. It's so nice to have you back where you belong.
I am so glad to be back.
Are you looking swell?
Thank you, Louis.
Dolly, I can tell.
Does it show?
Dolly, you still blowing, you still crowing, you still
going strong.
I feel the room sway and the band play. One of our
favorite songs.
So
it was my favorite.
Show some snap, fellas.
Yeah.
Find an empty love.
Yeah. Dolly will never go away again.
They're riffing with each other. I mean, she's kind of improvising over on top of, you know, nobody else does that. Bip, bip, bop, bop. I mean, she's
scat singing
Louis Armstrong.
Like Ella
she's
did.
She's scat singing
I mean,
with
it's,
him.
It's
yeah.
like Ella and Louis Armstrong
yeah.
together again.
So there, I mean, there's an element of performativity in that,
yeah.
you know, she's saying like, I can do your jazz shtick just as well as, you know, and there's a piece like, whoa, Barbara, like careful about, you know, like that's appropriation to a certain kind of degree. It's a little weird to have Louis Armstrong with a banjo. It's right next door.
To
minstrelsy.
Shows. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, so yeah, there's a piece of me that like, I don't know. And yet, you know, Louis Armstrong also made a ton of fucking money on that thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, like they all made money on this thing. Good for them.
Yes. Good for them. Good for them. It is a great moment. It's a phenomenal moment. And another great moment, of course, the anthem in a lot of ways is It Only Takes a Moment, right? It's virtually a hymn about, it's a hymn about romantic love, but it's also a hymn about I think theologically what we'd want to call Kairos time, right?
It only takes a moment for your eyes to meet and then your heart knows in a moment you will never be alone again. I held her for an instant, but my arms felt sure and strong. It only takes a moment to be loved.
Happen in a day. It didn't even he's like, what's shorter than a minute? Not a second. And then there's this like little old lady who's like, a moment. And that's what, right? Like, it's
yes.
the dumbest moment of all. He's like, yes, it's Michael Crawford, incidentally. I mean, really,
who
like,
becomes fan of the opera later, yeah.
Who becomes a fan of the opera. Also, you know, a famously queer actor who spends a lot of time in a closet as Cornelius. But he's great in this film. I actually really think Michael Crawford is great in this film. And sells the song, right? But it is. It's about Kairos. It's about what can happen. What's a unit of time that is shorter than a second? So at that point, we're not talking about time anymore. We're talking about a unit of time that expands out to become an entire lifetime. And that's really where the song goes, right? It only takes a moment to be loved your whole life long. He sees his entire his entire life, I think, encapsulated in the eyes of Irene Molloy, I suppose, right? When he, you know, falls in love with her. I used to think that was bullshit. And I did a funeral not that long ago for the wife of a guy who fell in love with her. She was a nurse. He walked into her operating room at 18. She was 19. She was engaged to marry somebody else. He had hurt his foot. They looked into each other's eyes, and 54 years later, they, you know, like, and he talked about it that way, right? We fell in love in an instant. We were together for 54 years. It was, you know, like, they had their ups and downs, sure, but theirs was a lifelong love affair. And I was thinking about them when I was watching It Only Takes a Moment the other night. Like, I used to say, like, okay, whatever. Like, that's, you know, that's a myth. Nobody falls in love in an instant. And my sense is, no, there are people who have that experience, right? It only takes a moment. So I don't know. I'm a little
it's
less.
It's deeper than meet cute.
Yeah, there's something, and I and I think the only way that I can frame that as something more than meet cute, or something more than a kind of toxic heteronormative script that really is about the subjugation of women. The only way that I can frame that theologically is Kairos.
Yes.
Right. Like, actually, we have a rich theological language for this idea of time that can stretch out, and that time to a certain degree is also meaningless and performed, but that there is, I mean, to quote Hamlet, a divinity that shapes our ends, or a few of them how we will, and that sometimes in an instant something can happen that can change your life. And sometimes that thing is falling in love.
And you and I have both talked about this in terms of asking people who are having intellectual problems with God, tell me about a moment. Right? It's usually, tell me a moment where you had some sense that the world was bigger than your little construction of it. And almost always people will reference a moment in nature, a moment with art, whether it's, you know, a moment in music, sometimes the falling in love. This is kind
sometimes of... Sometimes yeah. Meeting, having a child laid in your arms for the first... I mean, I think about kind of some of the great kind of classic moments when human beings sort of experience the fullness of the human experience distilled into one.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's like, I always ask people, like, when do you feel the chill up your spine? When do you feel the tears start to rise in your eyes? Often I think these moments happen in church.
Yes.
Right? Like, it's hearing something, a frisson. We talked about this in one of our very earliest episodes, hearing Julie Andrews sing the top note of I Could Have Danced All
Night.
Oh my
God.
Why does that moment make you cry?
I know.
And some of it, right? Some of it is she's really good at what she does. Yeah. And some of it is there is something very human and truthful. I mean, this gets back to Barbara and her training in the method, right? She is looking for a moment. She is looking to create a moment in which, as an artist, she makes something happen in the bodies of her audience. And in that sacredness, they are bound together. Something happens in the room. Now, you know, are people's lives changed by the moment at the top of the stairs in Hello, Dolly? I don't know. It makes you cry.
But
it's
makes
a lovely
you
moment.
Cry. You know, it makes... It's a deep noticing, a deep connection with the rumbling under. I'm with my hands kind of making like a river. There's a deep resonance with what it is. The ground of being is what Paul Tillich called it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
And that's what the theology of Kairos is it allows you to drop to a certain degree out of chronological time. You drop into divinity,
yeah.
Right? Like that is what Kairos is all about, is everything stops. You drop into the eternity, the life of the age, the life of the eternal life, I suppose,
eternal
right?
Life.
It's a moment of resurrection.
Yeah.
That's what kind of the gospel is all about, I think, is you don't have to wait until you die to experience this thing. Heaven is now. The kingdom of God is here. It is among you. And there are moments in this life where we experience divinity. Sometimes they happen in a Broadway theater. More often, I think they happen in intimate relationships with people whom we love, or maybe alone on a hillside, you know,
yeah.
When all of a sudden everything shimmers. But it only takes a moment.
For Cornelius, if it is a hero's journey that they're on, this is the moment where his life is transformed. It's romantic love. He goes back to Yonkers as a different person. He's been changed somehow in a deep way. And you know that the hero's journey, I think, is the journey of Jesus through wilderness, coming back into ministry. It's the when the tears rise up, when the frisson goes down your back, you are changed, but not necessarily in a way that you can articulate at the time.
Yeah. I mean, the pushback on the hero's journey archetype is that is primarily a male archetype.
Right.
So does Dolly get a hero's journey? What's her arc?
What is her arc? Yeah.
Does she have a moment?
Or is it just Horace Vandergelder who finally says, well, hell, she's here. She makes a lot of sense. She can do what she wants.
Yeah, I mean, do they fall in love? I mean, this is maybe another way of saying, like, do they love each other in the end? Or is it, I mean, the way that the script works, you know, it's like, I think her moment was when he gives her her sign. Yeah. She has basically asked her husband, I want a sign. I'm going to marry Horace. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's bad. Maybe it's safe. I'm ready to rejoin the human race. So it's more than just, I need the money.
Right. I think
some of it is, right, I'm ready to live again.
Her journey is one from grief to new life. It's moving from death to life, really. It's, again, discovering. It's the Paschal mystery. It's when she enters the Harmonian Gardens and
yeah,
she can go back there. I mean, the folks I know, and certainly in my own journeys of grief, there are places that you can never go again because it will activate your memories of your beloved in such a way that you can't do it. But she can go back. She's worked, something has worked through her. So, I mean, that would seem to me to be her journey. Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's that moment at the top of the stairs, right? Before the orchestra starts to play. And if it's a good actor playing that moment, Barbara plays this moment, I think, beautifully. There's both a sense of, I mean, she's a little smug. She's waiting at the top.
But there's apprehension. My sense is, like,
there's apprehension and there's grief there.
Yes.
Right? She's not sure if she can make it down those stairs.
Yes.
Because walking into that room is so fraught for her. And then the band starts to play. She begins the ascent. All of her boys are there. They do a big dance number. It is resurrection,
it's
right?
Resurrection.
That is a moment of, that's yeah. Jesus walking out of the tomb to a certain degree,
yeah.
Right? That's Lazarus come forth.
That's right.
Coming out of the closet. That's, you know, that's everything about embracing who you are, coming back into the parade. But that moment before she takes a step, right? That the pregnancy of the vulnerability in that moment, I think that's part of why it's such a powerful moment in the theater.
I think it's why it makes the show stop, and it works at a very deep level that you're not really, because you're just laughing. It's a great show. It's a great song. There's lots of shtick. Stick around for the jokes. You know,
there's lots of jokes.
There's lots of jokes. But at the core of it, it is this journey from out of death into life.
It's a resurrection story,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In that sense, I mean, like, of course it's one of our favorite shows because this is a musical that has a gospel at its center.
I think,
right?
So.
There's good news for human beings in Hello, Dolly. I see why it's such a juggernaut. I see why it works so well. But I think for our project, right, like, this is one of the places where I experience sacredness in the theater, right? It's a liturgy. Hello, Dolly is a liturgy. It's a liturgy of Easter. Yeah, it works.
With a side of slapstick.
With more than a side of slapstick. Yeah, slapstick and satire and some weird misogyny and a little bit of patriarchy. And yeah, there's other stuff in this show. But at the heart of it is that moment at the top of the stairs. And my God, that's a beautiful moment.
And Streisand just owns it. Absolutely.
Yep, she sells
owns it.
It.
She sells it.
Too young for the role, but oh boy, in that, yeah, in that 40-pound gold dress that she can barely move
pounds.
In.
Oh my God, that she can walk down the staircase is nothing short of astonishing.
Apparently, Irene Sheriff, who designed the dress, they called her in to some of the dance rehearsals. She was doing it in a mock-up muslin version, and the choreographer is like, you're going to have to change this dress. All the boys are, you know, they're stepping on the train. You know, she can't dance in this thing. And Irene Sheriff looked Michael Kidd dead in the eye and said, Michael, you'll have to change the choreography, and walked out. Although in the end, I think they did change the dress.
He did win
that one.
Yeah.
But I mean, at the end of the day, put on your Sunday clothes. Basically, at the end of the day, the show is all about the dress, and it's an amazing dress, so...
Great.
Go, Barbara.
It's so nice to have you back where you belong.
It is. It's so nice to be back home where we belong.
Here we are.
And to get to tease it. I'm so glad we finally got to talk about Hello, Dolly, because I knew that this was a show that you loved and that I loved.
Yeah.
We've taught it in the context of whiteness. I think I don't want to lose that aspect of it, the social critique and the clear-eyed view that it kind of presents of the economics of whiteness, the economics of white marriage. And I also want to say there's a beating heart at the center of the show, and I'm so glad to explore that with you a little
Yay.
Bit.
Yay. Amen.
Yeah.
Until next time.
Cool. Until next time.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at Gospel of MT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time.